The last two podcasts have been about the Lord Lucan murder mystery, how he killed his children's nanny, Sandra Rivett, and disappeared. You may recall back in episode one, we talked about the other Lucan nanny. Her name was Christabel Boyce. And Christabel had been due to be on shift on the night of November the 7th, but Sandra had swapped nights off and she was there in the basement and was attacked instead. For Christabel, it was something of a close shave. But her own life afterwards had a sinister twist with dark parallels to the murder she avoided in 1974. And Christabel's killing, a decade later, threw up new clues about the Lucan case from the 70s. Now, before we get going, there is some dark stuff in this episode. We never linger on the details, but if you're likely to be affected, this one may not be for you. For this episode, I'm joined by the screenwriter, George Kay. A lot of George's career is based in crime. For Netflix, he devised and wrote Criminal UK and Lupin. He was the brains behind one of Apple TV's biggest ever shows, Hijack. And here in the UK, his dramas for ITV include the BAFTA-nominated The Long Shadow, about Peter Sutcliffe, and Litvinenko. And George has, in the last month or two, discovered a personal link with Christabel's story. George, thanks for being with us. How are you?
Very well, very well. Thanks for... It's just such a funny personal connection that it's great to talk about it, really. This thing came up, so we were keen to chat, weren't we?
Yeah, this is something you just discovered, really, a few weeks ago, isn't it?
We've both got an interest in true crime, British true crime stories, I think. And I was talking to an actor about the Lord Lucan case, and he, who shall remain nameless, but is a great fun actor and talented guy, he brought up the Lucan, the Lucan story, which, you know, it's so well documented, isn't it? And it's so sort of lodged in all of our minds. I have a kind of part knowledge of it. I'm sure you're the same. Kind of so much of it's familiar, but there's lots of details that kind of that I don't know about, and I'm sure you're learning as well by talking to people like Laura. I had this really lovely chat with this actor, and afterwards, because I know my mother has a very good knowledge of this, and she lived in London and in and around that kind of class of people in the 60s a lot, and worked around Sloane Square, which I think is where Veronica ended up living, and there's lots of sort of mini crossovers with that world. So I mentioned this conversation to my mum and thought, this is quite, maybe it's quite a good story to dramatise, or maybe it's been done already. Rory Kinnear was in a dramatisation, I think Jeff Pope, ITV. And so we were talking about this, and mum said, well, did you tell the actor about your godfather's sister? And I said, what do you mean, my godfather's sister? What's this? And she said, well, your godfather's sister was the nanny before, was Christabel. And Christabel, as we subsequently discovered, was meant to have been working that night. I think Sandra Rivett was meant to be on a date with her boyfriend, and Christabel was going to step in. And judging from some of the cuttings that, you know, we've found together that you've sent me, and we've had a look at this recently, it seems that the date that Sandra Rivett was meant to have with her boyfriend was moved, and so Christabel wasn't needed to come back and do a night's nannying that night after all. And, you know, kind of sliding doors moment, of course, that's the terrible night of this tragic event. So I said to mum, you know, I have to talk to Christabel, because, you know, what a primary source. Amazing to talk to someone who would have known everyone involved. She obviously knew Sandra Rivett because they kind of crossed over shifts. It wasn't that Christabel had left the Lucan household or employment completely, and obviously knew Veronica and obviously knew John Bingham, or Lucan as we call him. Mum said, you can't talk to Christabel because Christabel herself was murdered by her own husband 10 years later. And the brutality of that murder is shocking. And the parallels that we started to look into, this is incredible. The parallels between the two crimes. So I think you were my first phone call. I think we talked about the fact that you were interested in doing a podcast about the Lucan case, and we always talk about these things. Yeah. And I said, I just come across this most, you know, incredible personal connection. my godfather's since passed away, and I don't know anyone involved. And I think Christabel and her husband, who was later convicted of manslaughter, they had children, and I was told that they had been, I think the phrase is, blindly adopted. There was a blind adoption, as in those children wouldn't have been told where they had come from or what the story had been, for their own kind of protection, was the thinking at the time. I don't know. A lot of these facts are very, very new to me, because, as you say, this is like a 3-week-old piece of information I was given.
What was it like for you at that moment with your mum, who, you know, you're a man in your 40s, here is a well-known crime, and you've gone and you've got this personal connection, not with just anyone, but your godfather. What's it like, yeah, to suddenly discover this link now, that about which you've been blissfully unaware?
I think the thing about Lucan as a case is that it feels completely kind of 19th century. You know, it's the 1970s that this happened, but the whole kind of appearance of Lucan, his name, the escape, it all feels like some sort of Victorian villainy. You know, and actually we were talking about this the other day, you know, the Beatles had broken up by the time Lucan had kind of escaped. You know, so much, it was like it was the 3-day week, wasn't it? This is 1974 we're talking about. It felt like a distant crime. So when I found this connection, it sort of brought it home as a very unfortunately modern thing, and the link with Christabel. And that crime feels grim, very bleak, very modern, but also completely similar in terms of some of the anger between the couple and the frustrations and the sort of the frustrated men. I'd talk about Lucan, and I'd talk about Nicholas Boyce, who was convicted of killing Christabel, and the sort of impotence of that. And these are sort of angry men lashing out and taking out their life frustrations, I would say, on their wives.
Let's talk about the importance of Christabel to the Lucan case, because we'll go into her awful death shortly, an unfortunate death and tragic death in a bit. But when police were investigating her death, they came across a diary. What do you know about the diary and about what it said?
Christabel's murder was in 1984, 1985, and so it's 10 years later. So this case has been notorious, the Lucan case has been notorious, the Sandra Rivett case, we should call it, by the way, has been notorious for 10 years, and tabloid fodder and all of this stuff, and so many theories swirling around.
Where's Lucan? Is he in South Africa? Is he in Australia? Is he in...
Yeah, where's Lucan? Yeah. It's like this whole game of where's Wally in the tabloid press. And even the most sort of like ridiculous theories are front page news for the Red Tops. And there's some crazy theories about whether Lucan himself was involved or what happened on that night. But in investigating the Christabel murder, the police found a diary that she kept, this kind of contemporaneous diary. And she went back to work, I think, for Veronica after Sandra Rivett had been killed.
And they were so friends. They were friendly, really friendly, weren't they?
Yeah, and they were friends. And so she was able to record in her diary that she didn't expect anyone to ever see what Veronica had told her. So the fact they were friends suggests that Veronica would have been fairly truthful with Christabel, you'd think. But it shed some light on what Veronica's attitude and thoughts were, or her account of it was, in terms of telling Christabel.
It was a 90-minute phone call, I think she said.
Okay.
I've got a copy here, yeah. It's a 90-minute phone call that she got from Veronica Lucan just a couple of days afterwards. And she said that in the minutes after Sandra's killing, Lucan suggested to Veronica that they have a suicide pact, that they should go away together, husband and wife, the Earl and the Countess of Lucan, and she should bring pills for an overdose, which you could think of might be another trick to take her life. And the quote from the diary, a direct quote is November 7th, 1974, 9 p.m. Lord Lucan murdered Sandra Rivett, Veronica Lucan's nanny, mistaking her for his wife. Veronica brutally attacked at 46 Lower Belgrave Street. 50 stitches in her head. Lucan on the run. Veronica in St. George's Hospital. Veronica told me the murder story. Sandra was watching TV with Veronica at 9 p.m. She went to make a cup of tea in the basement. Lord Lucan was waiting in the dark in the basement and beat her to death. Later, Veronica went down. He attacked her in the dark. The weapon was covered in bandages. He beat her, then tried to strangle her. She fought him like mad, and eventually he gave up and sat on the stairs. They talked, Veronica bleeding badly. He admitted killing Sandra. And then she added, "I hope they catch the bastard Lucan dead. I hope." This wasn't meant for anyone to see, was it? It was just a record.
Meant to be private, and was completely private for 10 years after. So she wasn't like she was wanting it to come out in any way. But it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think it maybe sheds a little bit of light on it. And of course, then that generated a load more tabloid headlines. It did. As the trial came about for Christabel and Nicholas Boyce, her husband.
Let's talk about them, shall we? Because I'm looking at a photo here. He's, so she, after working for Lucan, the Lucan family settled in London, the East End, and she married Nicholas in 1981. Just describe what they look like to us. How do they come across to you in the photo?
Well, he's quite sort of wild-eyed. In all the pictures, I've got lots of different pictures of him. It's quite well documented. Mm. But he seems quite a sort of, he's kind of fair-haired, wild-eyed guy. And she, across the different photographs we see in the press, goes from quite a tidy young woman to being perhaps a little tired looking. And yeah, you can really see that she's aged a little bit.
They look like a very normal couple, really. I mean, they're very smart. He's wearing a sort of suit, and a suit of the sort of 80s, a kind of sort of safari jacket with a tie and stuff. And he's got that 80s kind of big hair thing going on. They seem smiley, not particularly warm necessarily, he doesn't, but they seem just very average, really, don't they, to me?
It's hard to tell, but I wondered from the accounts, and maybe sort of trying to match the accounts to the pictures, whether or not they had quite a tough time in their marriage. I mean, clearly they had, in terms of the accounts of what happened. And I think he was an academic, but working as a cleaner while he studied for a master's. And she was obviously working and perhaps was kind of earning the money. And tensions began to rise between the pair of them, where he was studying and working a little bit, night cleaning, I think. And so a lot of the times she'd come home and find him asleep on the sofa, smoking his pipe, in the, you know, and it might look a little bit like a sedentary existence. The motivation for him to murder her, or the reason he gives is that he is provoked through this arguments and nagging.
Now we're going to take a quick break from Christabel to tell you about one of my favourite true crime podcast series about and by two incredible sisters.
24 hours ago, I found out the person that I'd been dating and seeing for the last 6 months as a con man.
That is my sister Emma. Andrew Tonks' lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual.
Coming up in this series, and that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris. And this is my story, Conning the Con.
No matter what the provocation, no matter what the cause, what Nicholas Boyce did to his wife, Christabel, was truly appalling. I think we need a little alert here for listeners. What he did was grim. What do the newspapers say?
This was in the Mirror, October 85, during the trial of Nicholas Boyce. A husband who cut up his wife's body and hid bits of her all around London told an Old Bailey jury yesterday of their last furious row before he strangled her. Nicholas Boyce, 37, said his wife Christabel twice kicked him to the floor, but he did not retaliate. Later, she taunted him about their sex life and said he was like a schoolboy in bed. Twice, she snatched pipes from his mouth and snapped them. When he lit up a third time, she ran towards him and he hit her across the room. Boyce, who was said to have suffered months of misery from his wife, added, "She then squeezed a lighted cigarette into my hair." I'm not quite sure how you do that. "I couldn't endure the torture anymore," he says. "I grabbed a piece of flex. I threw her to the ground, getting the flex around her neck and headbutted her furiously. I was not in control, certainly not by that time. When my senses came back, she was dead." So Boyce claims provocation.
Yes.
Says his life is a misery living with Christabel. And the sort of inference the judges or the jury's invited to draw is that poor old Nicholas Boyce, having to, not allowed to sleep in the daytime, having a complaining wife. And at some level, he claims this is the sort of retaliation is justified. And I mean, it's astonishing because the parallel, sorry, Rob, the parallel here is that, you know, there are accounts of Lucan at the Claremont Club feeling like Veronica is bored of him losing their money the whole time with his friends, money they can't afford to lose, and that she's somehow, you know, a nag or a pest or a thorn in his side as he's trying to have fun with the guys. And so you have these two cases where men are feeling provoked by their wives who are nagging them, or, you know, and to the point where they feel sort of at some level driven to physical attack and some kind of murder, you know. So the parallels struck me. What I'm shocked about with the Boyce defense is that he's provoked into murder and that's somehow acceptable. He claims that this was a hot-headed moment.
Yes.
After he kills her, he cuts her body up into, I think, 100 pieces. He bakes her in the oven and he goes around London with little bits of poor Christabel in carrier bags, depositing her into bins around London. He throws her head off Hungerford Bridge.
Yes.
I mean, it's absolutely horrific.
It is psychopathic, or beyond that. It's a scientific, almost, what he does to her and the sort of the rationale of what he did in the aftermath.
You can't claim a hot-headed...
Yeah.
Like, you know, at some point after that, he hands himself into the police.
It's 5 days afterwards, I think.
Yeah, 5 days later, he hands himself into the police. And he's given sort of credit for that. Mm. You know, at least you handed yourself in, the judge later says. But you can't claim that you're in this sort of state of, like, you haven't been provoked. If that's your defence, then the minute you've done something like this, you would go and hand yourself into the police. Yeah. But for 5 days, he tries methodically to get rid of her. And yet the judge doesn't seem to draw any point from that.
No. We'll get onto the trial in a little moment, I think. But the reason he put for cooking her was to cover up what he'd done, to make her remains. And this is so grotesque. Make her look like a Sunday lunch. He put her in 8 bags. 2 were found in Hackney Marshes, 2 in the River Thames, and 4 in an embankment near a tube station. And the head, he seemed to be able to do that somehow, yet he was squeamish in taking her. For some reason, he wanted to take her contact lenses out. And so he thought he would encase her head in concrete instead, which is just...
I think he put her head in concrete to make it sink, presumably.
Yeah.
But he threw the head off the bridge whilst walking his 3-year-old son around central London.
Yes. He had 2 children, I think, didn't he? And they were with him when he was doing all of this.
But then also in the trial, he claims that his wife had gone round the twist. I mean, This is a man who's headbutted, baked and chopped up his wife and all these things that we've talked about, these terrible things. And he's claiming that his wife was the one that went around the twist.
Yes.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's so sad.
He went on trial in London, didn't he? And he claimed this provocation, and he described other arguments. I mean, some of the other arguments was included that she just didn't like where she lived and she wanted a house with a garden for the kids. Just a kind of normal sort of marital discussion, really. It was hardly...
normal marital arguing and differences.
We need to earn more money. We need to get a better house, which is what lots of people argue.
And of course, she's not there to defend herself or put her side of the story across.
It struck me with this, comparing this with Lucan. And with Lucan, the only version of events we get is from one of the survivors, one of the victims, that being Lady Lucan, of course, not Sandra, because she's dead, and Lord Lucan, the attacker, the killer, has vanished. So we don't ever get his version of events. In this case, it's the complete opposite, because she's not around to describe it, and he is. So that you've got this completely different version of events, one being by the victim, and this one, in this case, by the attacker, and poor Christabel isn't around to defend herself. Okay. The trial, he admitted her manslaughter, Christabel's manslaughter, but he denied her murder. And he went on trial in London. And during the trial, he used all the arguments that we've heard about a moment ago, including the moment at which he attacked her. He did also, he said he took a bath afterwards as well. He said, "I didn't tell the police because I didn't want them to see what I've done." He, in his defence, he said, "I was overcome with despair," but the prosecutor, a man called Anthony Scrivener, described Boyce as a man of substantial intelligence who was very much in charge of the situation, who in fact killed her coolly and deliberately. He said, "Marriages break down, partners disagree, but an ordinary person doesn't resort to butting his wife with tremendous force, then strangling her when she's defenceless. It's easy to make allegations," he says. "She's not here to dispute them." I mean, as someone who sat through, I don't know, I've lost count. Yeah. There certainly were over 200 homicide, maybe 300 covered these cases. And sat, I don't know how many trials I sat through. It's always so one-sided when it comes to actual testimony, really, about the, you know, it is only ever the person who's standing in the dock you ever really hear from, unless there are, you know, in these cases, it will just be them behind the closed doors. It's only their account. There are no friends talking. There's no relatives talking. It's just his account about it.
Have you ever, in those 200 trials, heard anyone claim that they were provoked into murder in terms of... Is that quite common?
Yeah, all the time, yeah. Lots of times. And there was a Penelope Jackson case, which you might remember from a couple of years ago. So the husband, it was during lockdown, and they'd had a tempestuous relationship. She was his third wife. He was her fourth husband, I think. And it happened in the southwest of England. And it was a Valentine's Day meal, I think. And it all went wrong. They'd been drinking. And there was the 999 call to the police, and we saw the body worn video, and we heard the 999 call saying, "I've killed my husband, but don't," something along the lines of, "don't rush because, he's lying in the kitchen, but don't get here quickly because I want him to be dead." And when they turned up, she said something along the lines of, "I tried to stab him in the heart, but he doesn't have a heart." It's that kind of sort of arguments, and she was very clear about what she had done at that time when she was under the influence of alcohol.
Do you think after a murder that there's a sort of clarity? I mean, what with Boyce, he seems to get practical about this, and it's a very thorough process and quite a bizarre process, but there's a method there. A really unusual one.
The verdict. Tell us about the verdict.
So this is, I mean, I think this is the most outrageous part of the whole thing, arguably. But I, you know, I don't know the legal side of this, and I don't know how common this is. And you've sat through more trials than I have, for sure. So, I mean, maybe it's not as uncommon as it feels, but it feels wrong in all expressed and the attitudes taken, and I hope they're attitudes of the 80s rather than now, but you might be able to tell me more on that. This is from the Daily Post. A husband who hacked up his wife's body in the family bath after killing her during a row was cleared of murder yesterday. Instead, Nicholas Boyce found guilty at the Old Bailey of the manslaughter of his wife, Christabel, was sent to prison for 6 years. Mm. I mean, bear in mind what's happened. Boyce, looking pale, sighed and closed his eyes as the six-woman jury returned their unanimous verdict after just over 2 hours. Mm. So that's quick, isn't it?
Really quick, really quick. For something so debatable. And unanimous.
Unanimous in just over 2 hours. He had denied deliberately killing 32-year-old Christabel, a former nanny to Lord Lucan's children. Sentencing him, the Recorder of London, Sir James Miskin, said, "Before these dreadful events, you were hardworking, of good character, devoted to your children, and a good father. You were simply unable to get on with your wife." I mean,
terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, well, fair enough. Okay. You can't get on with your wife. I will deal with you on the basis you were provoked. You lost your self-control, and that a man of reason, this is the important bit, and that a man of reasonable self-control might have been similarly provoked and might have done what you did. So this is the world we are in, where...
It's absolutely terrifying, yeah. Isn't it? 1985. It's like, not 1885. And you give, to your credit, you gave yourself up. The first sentence of that, "I'll deal with you on the basis you were provoked," I can understand that, because he's been acquitted of murder. The manslaughter charge remains. And so the provocation must have been there. And he lost his self-control. That's fair enough. But a man of reasonable self-control might have been similarly provoked and might have done what you did is absolutely terrifying.
The judge added that in time, Boyce had helped police find Christabel's body.
Oh, well, that's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what a situation. Yeah, I mean, I think that's completely outrageous. And there's no progress from the attitudes taken by the Claremont set around Lucan and Veronica about what to do about Veronica, who's a pain in the ass. Mm. You know, I mean, it's astonishing. But the parallel is so frightening. And she's missed out on being the victim of the crime of the 1970s and become just as bad a victim of a crime of the 1980s.
Yeah.
And absolutely. it's astonishing. And to go back to your early question, that how humdrum this is in so many ways compared to the Lucan crime, that's what brings it home as a personal connection. Because you think, you know, even this kind of tabloid story has really sort of everyday parallels that affect the likes of you and me or anyone. And enough with the Claremont Club and Aspinall and his tigers and this whole glamorous world. These are really brutal, horrible crimes against women by frustrated, cowardly men,
yes.
In my view. So that sort of, in a way, when I was talking about that drama, I thought, this is a more interesting drama, actually. And this exposes the brutality of these crimes and cuts through all the tabloid crap. And, you know, I think Lucan, he's sort of clearly an unimpressive guy. He's a loser, really. He lost all his money. He was a house player at the Claremont Club because he couldn't bet effectively. He lost his wife's money. And he was too proud to deal with it.
When you look at cases, what is it? Because you've written Litvinenko, The Long Shadow about Peter Sutcliffe. What does a case need to have for you that makes you think, yeah, there's 6 hours in here or 3 hours in here?
With things like this, I really look for the connection with everyday people and everyday lives. What is the intersection between it? Take the Lucan story, this crazy, glamorous, like rich lifestyles that Aspinall and Goldsmith and all these guys had, and this murder that feels a million miles away from our own understanding in terms of the lifestyles of these people, that's very interesting as a setting. But the thing that I'm interested in is where that setting has its intersection with the decisions and the emotions of everyday people and everyday, the universality of that. And, Litvinenko was about a wife's love for her husband. And it was wrapped up in a story that was about Vladimir Putin and his regime and the lengths they shut up their enemies. In The Long Shadow, it was about the decisions that normal women were making when they were really up against it in Yorkshire in the late 70s. These are all decisions that you want the viewer to kind of relate to and understand, and puts them right at the heart of the thinking of the characters in the story. I think that our conversation today has changed my mind about doing a drama about Lord Luke, because what we've done by looking at Christabel is to take away all of that kind of glamorous tabloid packaging that all of this interesting coverage hangs on, and expose the truth about this brutal crime against a woman. The Christabel story is obviously, it's horrific, and it doesn't have any of that glamorous sort of setting. And it shows you just how awful these crimes are. And actually, I'd rather write a drama about Christabel than I would about Lucan, who I think is over-fetishized and a coward, and may he be long gone.
Well, George Kate, thank you very much indeed. We'll see what you do with it.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to chat.
This was the final part of the Behind the Crimes Lord Lucan trilogy. If you found this compelling, you may be interested in our three-part series about Wearside Jack. We have an incredible interview with Chris Gregg. He's the only detective who worked on both the Peter Sutcliffe case in the 1970s and the hunt for the Yorkshire Ripper hoaxer in the 2000s. In fact, he led that inquiry. Please don't forget to rate, review, to subscribe and share. It makes more difference than you would ever know. Behind the Crimes has been nominated for a True Crime Award in the Outstanding Indie Podcast category. That's in a few weeks' time. We're up against some huge indie podcasts, which I respect greatly. But we are a small outfit, and any support you can offer goes a long, long way. Ratings, reviews, shares, and biggest of all, subscriptions. Our next episode, out in a few weeks, will be a premium podcast documentary for paid subscribers. So if you want to join up, just hop on over to robertsmurphy.substack.com. Behind the Crimes is written, presented, and produced by me, Robert Murphy.